From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Author Marta McDowell, a gardener and landscape designer in contemporary New Jersey, has an enduring passion for digging into history, particularly into noted authors and their gardens, what she calls the connection between the pen and the trowel. She's written books from that vantage point on Emily Dickinson, Beatrix Potter, and Laura Ingalls Wilder, and now her latest is on the prolific author Frances Hodgson Burnett, author of the classic The Secret Garden. More in a moment, but first, this message.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall, available at colorblends.com.
Besides designing gardens, writing books, and lecturing extensively, Marta McDowell also teaches landscape history and horticulture at New York Botanical Garden. She's here today to talk about the subject of her latest book, Unearthing the Secret Garden, The Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett. Hi, Marta. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm well, thanks.
Cleaning up the garden, are we?
I am indeed. I'm just cutting down some clematis vine.
Oh, boy. In a windstorm the other night, a tour that I have of one old clematis tipped over. So I think it might have cut itself down.
There you go. Well, this one is one of those old, September blooming white ones.
That was
one my father propagated. So it's got a little special spot.
Oh, so I'll confess, and before we start, I should probably say we're going to have a giveaway of your new book, Unearthing the Secret Garden, with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. But I have to confess, this sounds probably terrible, but I don't frankly know if I was read The Secret Garden as a kid. I don't have a strong memory of it, having just read your book. It was first published, I think, as a serialized magazine article series or something in like 1910. Tell us about the book and really why it called to you to make it your latest project.
So it's never been out of print. I received a copy when I was probably 9 or 10, which was just the right age, because that's the age of the protagonist, Mary Lennox. So, you know, it's always nice when you can see yourself in a book. Mary Lennox was also really spoiled, which I think I was too, kind of, you know, surly. But we didn't get many books in my household. We were a go to the library every week family. So this really, it was sort of a notable event. And I loved the book, and I read it so often that the binding was all cracked. It was the edition by Tasha Tudor, who's a pretty well-known illustrator, but it's also been illustrated by lots of people. You know, frankly, Margaret, I didn't know anything about Burnett when I started on the quest for this particular book.
Well, and that's what's so astonishing, because, you know, there I am reading your book and it's like, oh my goodness, she's the author of Little Lord Fauntleroy, who people may have heard, they may have heard of that book, and 50 novels and a dozen plays, and oh my goodness.
Yeah, so here is like an absolute powerhouse author who just has fallen off the radar, except for just like definitely The Secret Garden, and maybe people remember A Little Princess. I wouldn't have passed a quiz on Little Lord Fauntleroy before I started down this particular rabbit hole.
Oh, okay. I think because of it's sort of, I remember it being used as sort of an expression of like, and maybe I'm wrong, but like a sort of a dandy or something, like gussied up little guy or something. I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of a pejorative. If people remember. At all, you know, it's like, oh, you're just a little Lord Fauntleroy.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we go. I had this author, didn't know much about her, but figured, well, anyone who could write about a garden so poignantly, whether for children or adults, must have had a garden of her own. Let's go see what I can find out. You know, that's really how this started.
I see. Okay. In the book, and I'm not going to be able to summarize it as well as you would be able to, Mary quite contrary, borrowing from another author, I think, right? Mary, the protagonist, she discovers this secret garden. So, and each person that's brought into it, other children and adults too, they're transformed by their experience in discovering this place. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that, about sort of the quick version of what happens to Mary and then those that she brings into the secret garden.
So like most fairy tales, first you bump off the parents. So in the case of the secret garden, Mary Lennox is born in India. Her parents are part of the British Raj. They die of cholera. And Mary is sent back to live with an uncle in the north of England, in Yorkshire, at a place called Misselthwaite Manor. Her uncle is a widower. His wife died 10 years earlier. And Mary gets wind from the servants that there is this locked up garden that is really off limits. So, you know, perfect thing to tell a child, you can't go in here. And so immediately she sets off trying to find it because it's intriguing, right? And she befriends a robin, which has a connection to Burnett's actual story. She makes sort of friends with a gruff old gardener named Ben Weatherstaff. That has a connection to Burnett's life story. And eventually she finds this garden. She also, she discovers like that plants come back to life. And that to me is the most moving part of the book. It's like, oh, that time in the winter when everything seems dead.
I love in the book where you ask the reader, you Mark, to ask the reader whether they've had their own secret garden moment. And you write, where you stepped into the garden and felt a shiver of something, recognition, awe, you know, kind of what was it? And I think we've all had that. And I think that's why even though it's a children's story, it's, you know, sort of metaphorical for so many of us, this discovery and this magical place that then can transform us. Yes?
Yes. And so I think especially in our current times, right? A lot of people have come to gardening or come back to gardening because it is a relief. It's like you can get to a different place in your head, if that makes sense, sometimes just by observing things coming back in the garden.
Yeah. Now, each of the women, each of the authors that you've written about, and I think all of your subjects have been women. Yes, they've all been women and in their gardens. They have a particular plant palette, you know, sort of a signature of plants. And I mean, I think as when we talked a while back, Emily Dickinson, she loved her flower garden, her lilies, her roses. I don't remember Laura Ingalls Wilder's favorites on the prairie and so forth. But let's talk a little bit about the palette that delighted Frances, you know, her delphiniums, for instance. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. So delphiniums, you know, her son later wrote that delphiniums were her greatest triumph and her greatest tragedy. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you, Margaret, but, you know, once in a while you'll grow a plant and it will do so well that you just, you know, I think, oh, I'm a genius. I can grow X, Y, Z. Well, for Burnett, it was delphiniums. Now, delphiniums, I've tried to grow them in my New Jersey garden. You know, honestly, it's like about, you know, we don't like New Jersey. We want to be in Portland. You know, Burnett had this garden on Long Island, and she grew so many delphiniums, she called it my land of the blue flowers. That was the only year she had that. I have a kind of grainy, washed out picture of just, it looks like hundreds of delphinium.
Oh, wow.
And after that, right, of course, she has planted a monoculture. So it's been like this, you know, kind of neon sign for all the pests and diseases. She can never do it again. And the best she can do is like hide a few in her mixed borders.
Yeah. So. She called them larkspurs made big and grand, I think.
Yeah, isn't that a great expression?
Yeah, it is. It is great. And she loved roses. And I love the anecdote that if you want help with your roses besides your soul, if you want help with your roses, you go to the vicar, because the local vicar always knows how to deal with roses.
Yeah, so she started on her rose growing bender when she had a garden in the south of England in Kent. So Burnett, first of all, as you can tell from this, she really got around, you know.
Yes.
Never mind modern day travel, but this woman must have spent so much time on these, you know, steam liners going back and forth across the Atlantic, because she went everywhere.
Yeah.
So she created this garden in the south of England. And she was 50 years old, and she absolutely was bitten by the bug of gardening. Like, mm-hmm. She said, it's my new fad. She was always kind of over the top. And so she starts to, you know, she has some staff. So she says, go buy plants, go buy 1,000 plants. And I think most of them were rose bushes.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, she had a big canvas to work on. So, you know, unlike my little garden, she started out with 200 acres.
Right. And then sort of at the other end, you know, not quite as, I don't know, I think of roses as a, you know, classic sort of English garden plant at a grand estate and blah, 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 you know, pillars of roses and roses trellised and this and that. But then she got addicted to zinnias, the big hybrid zinnias, which surprised me. And she said she was educated up to them, meaning.
Yeah, so she didn't like them for a long time.
Yeah.
But then during her life, so, you know, she's born in 1849. She lives to 1924. So, you know, by the last quarter of her life, there's a lot of hybridization going on, and nurseries and seed catalogs are bringing out these giant zinnias. And, you know, I think she was kind of a petite person. She, you know, I think she was always sort of fighting, you know, she's this like self-made, you know, self-supporting woman, essentially in the Victorian era. And so I think there was something about zinnias that she really liked, the big ones, you know,
yeah,
that would just get big and bold and keep on producing, because she did love cut flowers. She was not a vegetable person at all.
Right. And she speaks about deadheading as master's work. You know, that it's important, I guess. It's, you know, it sort of elevates it, the deadheading. And because she deadheaded the zinnias, she got more and more and more progressive.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. Zinnias, roses, you keep cutting and they keep coming. If you stop cutting, they stop coming.
Right. Of course, she didn't like the color magenta. So those are the only ones she didn't really like, right?
Yeah. You know, why magenta? I don't know. I like magenta flowers, but she didn't like it. And, you know, one great thing about gardening is you can indulge your own preferences, right?
Yeah.
Because it's my garden. That's why. And, you know, she grew what she liked. Her son, who eventually lived next door to her on Long Island, always wanted, you know, to have some more vegetables, and he had to hide them. He called it his sneak garden.
Not his secret garden.
No, his sneak garden. You know, he had to sneak them in some unobtrusive corner.
Interesting. And bulbs were another thing she writes about, and you write about in the book about her. Bulbs with their, quote, little sharp green points coming up in the woodlands and so forth in early spring, and the delight of that, which of course all of us as gardeners, that's one of the things, the signs of life again, you know, after the frozen months, right, is those little green points.
Absolutely. You know, I am out there, you know, the minute the ground freezes, I'm out there scouting, you know, are the snowdrops up yet? You know, are those little winter aconites poking up their funky alien little heads?
Yeah. And so she had a lot of snowdrops in the woods and bluebells and daffodils and so forth. And then I guess there's is it a native primula to England? Is that correct?
Yes. It's primula. I think it's vulgaris. It's the you know, the vulgar, the vulgar or wild one. It's a pale yellow. It's a beautiful, beautiful primrose. And, you know, it's like, why doesn't that come up in my lawn instead of all the weeds I have. I'd rather have that one.
Oh, I know. We have dandelions, right?
That's right.
So you mentioned this just a second ago about catalogs, you know, poring over catalogs. And it was fun to see in the book that you mentioned it as well, like you uncovered details about, for instance, how she learned a trick, a horticultural trick, for instance, with gladiola corms, to not plant them all at once. You know, she order them from the catalogs, but you don't plant them all at once because then you get all your flowers at once, but you stagger them like every week or whatever. And it just made me long for some of the original garden catalogs that I used to read a million years ago. Some of them today, because, you know, a lot of it's online and so forth, we don't read as deeply, I think. We don't sit with the catalogs the way that we once did, maybe. But that they were such educational resources. And it sounded like she learned so much from them. So that made me kind of, you know, yeah, that was sweet.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember that same feeling, you know, kind of in my 20s, first getting my own space, my own little bit of earth, if you will, for a garden, and getting, you know, there were these catalogs that were so rich in detail, you know, not only the botanical name, but how you pronounce it and how you plant it and all these little hints. And I would just spend hours poring over these catalogs. And so I imagined Burnett doing that too.
Yeah.
She
yeah.
would write to her son. You know, she was not a person who liked the cold. So she'd spend her Long Island winter, she'd go to Bermuda. And she'd write to her son in New York and go, you know, has this and this catalog come in? Can you please send it to me?
Yeah, I mean, in a way that, like the different plants, some of which, I mean, I love zinnias, for instance, so, you know, so like, just like the different plants, you know, it takes, we're talking about over a century ago. And there was this continuity, this feeling of continuity and commonality, like, oh yes, she's a gardener too. We're all gardeners connected by these things, like the joy when the catalogs arrive, like the beautiful colors of zinnias, you know, these kinds of things. You know, the poking through of the first tips of the first bulbs. You know, these are universal things then and now and forever, hopefully, you know.
They are.
Bring joy.
They are. And I think the Secret Garden came out of another really universal occurrence with gardeners, when you realize that you might not have this garden forever, right? And, well, you won't have this garden forever. At some point, it's
right.
going to transition to someone else. For Burnett, it happened in England. She had had this garden that she loved at a place that she said was my only real home. And she loses it. She had been renting it as a, you know, as a property. It goes on the market. And for a variety of reasons, she decides not to buy it. And I think it was a trauma. And she wrote through that. And because that is exactly when she writes The Secret Garden.
Ah. Okay. So to get sort of some kind of closure, maybe to pour it all out what was in her heart. Huh? Interesting.
Yeah. So she had this country place, Maytham Hall, and she, you know, invites all her friends there. It's a place of entertainment. It's a place of great joy. It's also a place of work, because she constantly worked to maintain her lifestyle.
Yeah.
But she wrote to one of her friends and she said, "The Secret Garden is our rose garden," meaning this little walled rose garden that they made. If it had been locked up for years and years and some hungry children had found it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all about nostalgia for her roses, for her robin, that, you know, she makes this like connection.
Right. The friendship. Yeah.
Yeah. With a bird. Of course, when I was a kid, I always thought of our big American robins, but they have little English, cute English robins.
Yes. Well, so you just mentioned her lifestyle and working to keep it up and so forth, and all the different places that she lived and all the steamships that she had to travel on. So, you know, and her home in the United States was this estate in Plandome on, you know, overlooking the water in Long Island. And was her life grander than some of your other subjects of your past books? Was that a difference?
Well, certainly grander than Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yeah.
You know, Beatrix Potter was raised in a family with money. Mm-hmm. Emily Dickinson was certainly in the comfortable classes. You know, she didn't have to work. Burnett was born into a family that was, I'd say, comfortable. She was born in England, and they lost everything. So I'd say, you know, she had this kind of riches to rags to riches story. And got back to, you know, being able to do what she did through her own hard work from the time she was a teenager. So,
right.
You know, she was kind of a writing machine, and we
50 novels. Oh my goodness.
I mean, we have no feeling for her. And you know, if I read a few of her adult novels, and I understand why. You know, they're, you know, kind of sentimental and a little melodramatic, and they wouldn't be to our modern taste. But, you know, still, she was popular at the time and always looking for, you know, how can I monetize this?
Yeah. So toward the end of her life, she felt a prediction she had made maybe 20 years earlier, quote, to write a garden book someday. And I think it started as a series of magazine articles called Gardening for Everybody. And even though she'd by then, you know, been gardening for a long time, she writes with the wonder and delight in it of a newcomer. Like, you know, again, the astonishment at those like little green soldiers poking through the bulb tips and the breathlessness she describes at waiting. And I think she, you quoted her saying, for waiting for tiny seeds, little black things that she bought, by the way, just for like 25 cents a packet back then and poked into the dark soil, waiting for them to come to life. And she writes, and then suddenly out of the darkness leaps life. And, you know, that again, that wonder persisted to the end, right? I mean, I hope it does for me, too. And I guess you probably do, too.
Yes. And to me, the most astonishing thing is she really writes that on her deathbed, practically. I mean, she's during her final illness. She is writing this little series of articles for a magazine. And after she dies at home, so she dies on Long Island, and her son decided that he instead would collect them and publish them as a small book called In the Garden.
Uh-huh.
And it really was lovely when I found that she had left that behind. And she had left it behind not at the beginning of her, you know, sort of exploration of gardening, but at the end, it seemed like a real gift. And it's so hard to find. I just put it at the end of my book.
So, so in just like the last minute, a favorite takeaway. I mean, I'm the kind of person who like pins quotes up on my bulletin board from favorite things I've written. Is there a favorite takeaway for you from her that you want to share with us?
He said, and I'm not going to get the quote exactly right,
okay.
But she said something to the effect of, I'm flower drunk. I need flowers in every season, spring, summer, fall, but especially winter. And, you know, as I have my refrigerator crammed with bulbs that are going to be forced sometime at the end of February or beginning of March, I really understand that you get hungry for it.
Ha, huh, flower drunk. I like that. That's good. And good for your health, too. Unlike the other kind.
I think she liked to indulge in a little. She imbibed a bit as
Tipple.
Well.
Well, it's lovely to learn about it because, again, this wasn't a book of my childhood. So it's lovely to learn about it through you, as always, through your work. And we will have a giveaway, as I said, with the transcript of the show on awaytogarden.com. We'll have a giveaway of Unearthing the Secret Garden, your book about her and her work. So thank you so much for making time today, Marta. And now get back to clean up.
Thanks, Margaret. It's always delightful.
And then drive up here and help me.
Yeah, I think I should have. Next time, I promise.
Okay, we'll do each other's gardens. I think that's what everybody should do. They should go do someone else's. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall. Available at colorblends.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. Or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.